Welcome back to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Frances Moore LePay is considered one of the important voices in environmentalism. She first gained prominence in the early 1970s with her book, Diet for a Small Planet, in which she argued that world hunger isn't caused by a lack of food, but ineffective food policy. She's written some 17 other books addressing issues of food, hunger, and democracy. The most recent is Eco-Mind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. And she and her daughter, Anna, established the Small Planet Institute, based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's a collaborative network for research and education to bring democracy to life. LePay is in Vermilion for an Earth Day talk at the University of South Dakota, and she joins us here in our studios. And Frances, thanks so much for joining us on Dakota Midday.
Thank you, Carl. I'm enjoying every second since I landed here. This is so exciting for me.
Great. And if you have any questions for Frances Moore LePay, you can give us a call at 800-524-3604, 800-524-3604. I'm sure she'll say a lot of things, intriguing things that you might have questions about. You can also email us at midday@sdpb.org. And in reading some of your work and hearing some of your talks, what's interesting is that, you know, so much of what we hear about environmental health and economic and other challenges, there's so much doom and gloom involved. It's so easy to get overwhelmed with pessimism, but that's not your approach when talking about these.
No, I think that's the killer.
That's the killer.
Yes. We need all hands on deck. We need all the energy. And so what I call myself, Carl, is not an optimist, certainly not a pessimist. I am a possibilist. And to me, when you think like an ecosystem, which is the idea of my book, Eco-Mind, that you see everything is connected, everything is changing. This is the nature of life, moment to moment. So we're all co-creating. We're all co-creating every choice we make. So it's not possible to know what's possible. So that makes me a possibilist, that we can turn what can appear to be disaster into a better life on Earth for all creatures. We can do this. And we're so many signs all over the Earth that we can do this. So why not remain in a it's possible framework?
So is this a point of view where you're reacting to things?
Yes. Well, this book and this message came to me a few years ago when I walked out of a big environmental conference with all my heroes speaking. And when I walked out, I felt like the proverbial ton of bricks hit me. And I thought, oh, no. If I'm feeling depressed and immobilized, this is not working. And so we have to rethink about the environmental crisis in a way that actually gives people energy and not pie in the sky hope, but honest hope, a sense of possibility. And my theme is that what really does human beings in is not a big challenge, whether it's hunger or climate change. What does us in emotionally and immobilizes us is feeling useless, is feeling powerless. Human beings, we evolved to be doers, to be problem solvers. And when things are presented to us, it's really scary and overwhelming and in somebody else's power, that's when we get depressed and suicidal. I mean, suicide rates are going up.
Now, the Eco-Mind, the title of your book, what exactly is the Eco-Mind? Now, you mentioned this is basically the concept is ecology, an ecosystem, and you're just applying that to the way we're thinking.
Yes. My big aha in the 90s is that the only thing powerful enough to have us creating together a world that none of us as individuals would choose, because nobody gets up in the morning and says, yes, I want more people to go hungry. Nobody gets up in the morning and says, yes, I want to heat the planet and destroy plants and animals. So why are we doing this? The only thing powerful enough is if you look at the human mind, is that we see the world according to our ideas. And if our ideas about life are flawed, if they're not really related to reality, then no matter how hard we try, we're going to fail. So I tried to look, what are the core ideas? What is the mental map that is perversely aligned with human nature and with nature, and it's what we now live within. And I call it the scarcity mind, the idea that there's not enough of anything. There's not enough goods, there's not enough energy, there's not enough, in my city, Boston, not enough parking places, you know, you name it, there's not enough. And there's not enough goodness in us, that human beings are fundamentally flawed. So if you start with that sense of lack, there's not enough, then you live in a state of fear. And I believe that we are creating what we fear then, because we distrust ourselves, we distrust government, we turn over our fate to some impersonal law that Ronald Reagan called the magic of the market, which concentrates wealth, and it ends up actually creating the experience of scarcity amid plenty. So in a nutshell, I believe that we're living within a false mental frame that is taking us down. It's not because it's inevitable. It's not because human beings can't do this or that we're evil. It's because that we don't have the right questions in our minds. And that's what my book in my life is about.
Do we all... You talk about these different ideas. We all have different ideas and different approaches and perspectives. So how do you unite all these things?
Well,
when
good question. Well, I think underneath so many, whether it's left or right or center, this idea of scarcity, whether it's the left wing environmentalists saying, wagging the finger and saying save, you know, there's not enough to go around, or it's the more right wing. View, I think this fundamental sense of lack is a premise of telling us there's not enough, there's not enough goodness in us, you know, that human evil is. I know it's a big claim, but I think it's a generalizable frame of this presumption of not enoughness. And I think that this distrust of self, whether it's the right-wing version or the left-wing version, is really a problem. And so the eco-mind, it's just the way things are. You know, the science is telling us now that everything is connected. The only thing that's constant is change. And since everything's connected and everything's changing, then our choices are really creating our reality around us. And that means that we have power. And so I like to say the only choice we don't have is whether to change the world. Because everything from what we put into our mouths, to what we teach our children, to what jobs we take, to what clothes we buy, to you name it, all of those are rippling out and creating either a world that we really want to pass on to our children or not. So we have power. That's the key idea.
The fear of the limits, the fear of scarcity, is this something that is basically been a lot of what you've been writing about going back to, you know, 40 years?
40-something, more than that. Yeah.
First book came out.
1970, I was sitting in the library, and people were telling us, oh, hunger is inevitable. We run out of food. We've run out of food. Famine. There was a book that came out called Famine 1975. So I went to the library, and I said, oh, is that true? And I took my dad's slide rule and literally started kind of adding the numbers. And I had that first aha. Wait a minute, there's more than enough food. There's more than enough food, and yet so many are going hungry. It's more true today. There's something 30 to 40% more food for each person on Earth than when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet, which came out in 1971. Today, this figure you may have heard, we waste one half of all food. Every day, for every person, a pound of food wasted. So food waste alone, if it were a country, its waste would be the third largest greenhouse gas emitter, because producing all that food and it's rotting, that produces so much greenhouse gas. So my point is, the waste is monumental. And also our whole system of production, we're using about 3/4 of our land, our agricultural land, to produce livestock. And yet the calories we get back in the flesh from eating livestock are about 16% of all of our calories. So there's another way that we're shrinking the capacity. So my point is that the resources are plentiful. It's how we use them, whether we use them in a way that really supports life, our health, and the life of everyone or not. And that we now know what it takes, and this comes to my democracy theme, we now know what it takes to create societies that are really aligned with nature, that then we are actually using the earth in a sustainable and not just sustainable, but a flourishing, thriving way.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and we're talking with Frances Moore LaPaix, And her most recent book is EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. And she's in Vermilion for Earth Day. She's giving a talk this evening at the University of South Dakota. She's also discussing living democracy this afternoon with some USD students. And you were talking about that notion of a living democracy. And I think this was in one of your earlier books about living democracy versus a thin democracy.
Right.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, you know, I said that, Carl, that one of our limiting problems was the power of ideas. And right now we're kind of stuck because the only idea we have of democracy is elections plus a market, this very distant, structured ideas far away from us and less and less accountable to us. And what we need and what we must have to move forward is a vision of a democracy that truly works because it engages us and draws out the very best in us. And that's why I call it living democracy, because it's not simply elections plus a market. It is actually a way of life in which we're engaging in our schools, in our communities, and that fundamentally, in the political realm, we are removing the power of private wealth over our political system. Right now, there are 24 lobbyists in Washington for every person that we elect to represent us. And so what happens is policies get skewed then away from the benefit to all and toward the very few. And that's one reason, one main reason, that wealth is increasingly unequal in this country and in all other places where we don't have real democracy. So this is the idea of shifting from democracy done as something to us and for us, democracy as a living practice that we teach our children, everything from, you know, grade school classrooms where kids are learning to mediation skills so they don't have to just run to the teacher. They actually learn how to work out differences among themselves. That, to me, is teaching a culture of democracy where we're actually actively changing the rules all the way up to changing the rules to keep money out of control and putting our voices in so that our voices are heard.
I'm guessing you probably have very strong opinions on the recent McCutcheon ruling from the Supreme Court about removing the limits in some of the financing.
And this campaigns goes to the very heart of, I would love if we had time, but we don't, to talk to your listeners about this. What is democracy? Is democracy simply our capacity to spend unlimited amounts to get our view heard? Or is democracy fundamentally about the right of all of us to be heard? And if we're in a room, metaphorically, where one person is screaming and the other person can only talk in a normal voice, that's not democracy. And so the screaming is the representation, the metaphor for money overwhelming the airways because they can buy the, you know, literally, you know, the millions and millions of dollars worth of airtime. That overpowers the person who can just speak in a normal voice. That's not democracy. Democracy is the right not just to vote, but to be heard and to be listened to.
How does this relate to the EcoMind that that concept that we were talking about earlier? Is this closely connected?
Very closely, because in the EcoMind concept, the idea is that every entity, including the human organism, our species, we're all shaped by the context that we're in. And so we have to look at every plant and animal, what brings out the best in them. In other words, what allows them to flourish and not. And our species, I hold that three things allow our species to flourish. That is the dispersion of power so that one person, whether it's a bully or a fascist dictator, is not lording over us. So dispersion of power, transparency. We do not do well with secrecy, as we saw with what was going on Wall Street that we didn't know anything about. So number two condition is transparency. We don't do well with secrecy. And number three, we do not do well with cultures of blame, where it's always, oh, it's the 1% or it's the 47%. Wasn't that what Mitt Romney said?
Well,
anyway,
yeah.
It's the other guy. So my thesis is, and this is the EcoMind idea, that we look at what is the context that brings out the very best in us, and then we work through living democracy, that is this practice of democracy, to create those three conditions: dispersion of power, transparency in human relationships, and mutuality. So yeah, I can blame you or I can hold you accountable for your piece, but I've got to hold myself accountable for being like the financial crisis. Where was I in 1999 when they pulled away the regulations that then allowed the financial crisis that has literally killed millions of people? So we're all, if we're all connected, we're all implicated. We're all part of the solution as well as the problem. And that's the, to me, that's very empowering.
Now, in relationship to that, also getting back to the book EcoMind, this is closely related to what you write about thought traps that,
yes.
that we get caught in, ways of thinking, and I believe you have seven of those. And where did you come up with the idea of thought traps? Are these traps that you found yourself or other people that
yes.
were active in environmentalism that were
yes.
thinking this way?
Yes. I mean, some of them are literally messages of the environmental movement, of the main environmental movement. Some of them are just sort of ideas that are out there in our culture. So they're kind of a mix. For example, one key one is that I take on is the idea that growth is the problem and we've got to stop growth if we're going to save the environment. And I'm saying, no, wait a minute. You know, if you're out of work and you hear that message, you're going to run. So my point is there are really deep problems with that message. One, to say that our problem is growth is to say that what we're doing now is something positive, because most people think, you know, you want our children to grow, mm-hmm. your flowers to grow, your love to grow. So we're calling what we're doing now something positive, when I think if you look at the figures in my book and many places, you'll see that we should really think of it as an economy of waste and destruction. Most of the energy in the U.S. is wasted, for one. So I take on that whole idea of framing it as a problem of growth. The problem is that our economy is waste and destruction. And actually, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just said, in effect, this is from a New York Times columnist who was reporting about this report, said that if we took the most drastic steps to stop climate, you know, to mitigate, to deal with climate change in a positive way, the most, you know, the steps that they're recommending, the effect on our global growth would be 0.06%. It would be a rounding error. It would have, you know, we could do this without in any way touching the positive growth we need. Think of Germany. Growth, tremendous growth in what? In solar. For example, in 2010, Germany, which is about the size of Montana, it has a cloud cover about of Alaska, it produced about half of solar energy in the year 2010. That is growth. That is incredibly positive growth. So I just think that's a framing, that's a language, but it's also a way we think, that getting away from thinking that what we're now measuring is growth. It's not. Most of it is waste and destruction. And moving in toward thinking, how can we create flourishing economies, vital economies that bring out the very best?
This sounds like by rethinking these terms like growth, that maybe this will allow more of conversation among
yes.
different parties and different interests, because it seems like we're so split in two different sides of this, that there's no room to even have a discussion anymore. And do you think that changing how we think about the concept of growth, thinking about these terms in different ways, that'll help in some way in having a conversation?
Yes, I believe that is nobody, very few people respond well when you're pointing a finger of blame at them and preaching at them. And so I think, and as well as scaring them, like I say, if you're out of work or afraid of losing your job and you hear that, well, we've got to cut growth, you're just going to shut down. So I think, yes, that these are part of it is languaging, but part of it is really just rethinking. For example, when I started writing this book, I learned so much, because I realized that instead of just thinking about cutting emissions, cutting back, sort of retrenching, which already puts you on that track of stopping, much of the solution to climate change and a better life is actually starting and building on, for example, our food choices and the way we farm has tremendous greenhouse gas emissions. About over 40% of greenhouse gas emissions are not about fossil fuel carbon. They are about how we use the earth and how we can then store more carbon in the soil through our positive relation, you know, through protecting forest, reforestation, and through organic farming, for example, ecological farming. So it puts us in a very positive frame if we think about it as a cycle that got off balance, and how can we each contribute, and what are the choices that we make every day. And I think most people want to be part of the solution. And I think as we offer people more and more of being part of the solution, and that's why I love this Earth Day theme here. It's all very practical things that people can do, whether it's, you know, just pledging not to use plastic bottles because we know we don't need those. We can have a wonderful, a jar that, you know, a mug that we carry around and a canteen sort of thing. And we know that we can choose more organic. Yes, it may cost a little bit more, but think about how we give donations to things often, and think about that extra money that you're paying for organic. It's health insurance in a way, and it's also health for our planet insurance, and it's encouraging small farmers for the most part. So, you know, just seeing how our individual choices, this is the positive, not a Pollyanna, but power. Where is our power? That's the question I've been asking.
Well, we're just about out of time here. Only have a couple of minutes here, but I wanted to ask you about an interview that you recently did. You recently had a talk with Jane Goodall about sowing the seeds of hope. I'm wondering what you learned from that experience of talking with her about. I'm assuming you were talking about her latest book.
Yes, yes. Well, I so loved sitting on the stage with her in this interview. And what I so learned from Seeds of Hope, a brilliant, beautiful book, is, you know, it's all that she shares with us about plant life and our connection. It just opened my heart in a new way. You know, I mean, I've been doing this all my life, but I think the biggest impact on me was just that, you know, we know that as we get to know our partners and our friends better, we love them more. And she, like, made me love our earth more, because it's not a preachy, you know, negative book. It's all about what people are doing and just fascinating information about our connection. Particularly, this is a focus on plants. She's known for her work with chimpanzees, mm-hmm. but of course she realizes it. I asked her, why plants now, Jane? The chimps still need you too. And she said, yes, but the chimps need plants. They need forests to be in to survive. And so this is not a departure from her. And I just think that especially for all the young people out there looking for a positive example of somebody who's chosen this very gutsy life that Jane Goodall has chosen, and then continues. We sang Happy Birthday to her, and my granddaughter got to give her a handmade birthday card that said, "I love animals too." And, you know, she's 80 years old and going strong. And so that was, you know, I just felt so empowered by that person's path of what I think now, you know, as you know, I think that it's not that we need to be better people, but we do need to be more courageous people. We need to step out of the pack and say, okay, there's a better way. And that's what Jane Goodall represents to me from her earliest years. You know, she was looking at the chimpanzees and breaking with the traditional view at that time, and she still is. So I think that's a great example of what I mean by what's needed now is more courage.
We're talking with Frances Moore-LaPaix, and she's speaking at USD this evening. And quickly, here we got about a minute left. What sort of things are you mostly talking about? The eco mine?
Yes, I will, and particularly around the food piece of it, and what I'm learning about the food climate change connection, and in both the negative and the positive. And I show some slides from examples. I was just in India a year and a half ago with a life-changing trip where I met the lowest caste Indian women who 20 years ago had been just absolutely flat out, you know, near starvation and humiliated by landlords and beaten by their husbands, down and out, and turned it all around through ecological farming, and now are just the picture of living democracy. So I'm going to be telling a little bit about them, and you'll get to see them in my slide.
All right. Well, Frances Morlepe, thanks so much for stopping by and talking with us on Dakota Midday.
My delight. Thank you, Carl.
And she gives a talk this evening at the University of South Dakota as a part of USD's Sustainable Series for this Earth Day. That begins at 7 o'clock in the Munster Center Ballroom. She's also leading an afternoon discussion on how to foster the development of a living democracy in communities, and that begins at 2 o'clock in Farber Hall.